small firm entrepreneur architects. Get ready to build a better business with the Entree Architect podcast, where business meets architecture. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, the host of Entree Architect podcast. Join me every week for inspiring interviews with passionate people that share proven strategies to help you build a better business.
If you think there is a problem, one, you can't make a move until you have a plan in place. The accountability chart really helps plan, okay, for the business 6 to 12 months out, this is what we need.
We cover it all, from financial management to marketing, sales, productivity, and beyond.
There's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work. So you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work. So you charge way more.
I'd also say lagging measures, one of the best, like the best. So for any client, for any professional service company, if you're going to take one thing away from what we're talking about today, is to look at a number called the labor efficiency ratio.
Entree Architect is not just a podcast. It's your secret weapon for success. With over 500 episodes, it's one of the longest running architecture podcasts in the world. You're sure to find the information you need to elevate your business. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now and join the community of small firm entrepreneur architects building better businesses.
Hey there. Before we start, we want to apologize for a few technical difficulties throughout this episode. Recording sound issues. Nurjati recently moved to a new space. Yay! But she's still figuring out the best location for her to record. Also, sadly, we lost the last 5 minutes of our interviewee's audio, where she shared closing remarks. But we were fortunate to have the opportunity to speak with a living legend, and most of that conversation was salvaged. We really hope that you enjoy hearing a story told by a lady in her own words.
Hi, y'all, and welcome to another episode of She Builds Charrettes.
As a reminder, in these charrettes, we talk more about certain topics, make major announcements, conduct interviews. Basically, She Builds Charrettes is our playground for things outside our typical format.
Right. So no need to worry. We are still doing our regular show.
Today, we are beyond excited to have a conversation with Yasmin Ladi. She is the first woman in Pakistan to become an architect and open her own firm, Ladi Associates. And she is a member of the Royal Institute of British Architects.
Some of her most iconic projects include the Angori Bagh Housing, the ABH Complex, the Taj Mahal Hotel in Karachi, the Finance and Trade Center in Lahore, and the Pakistan State Oil House.
Alongside her husband, Suhail Sahir Ladi, she founded the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan, which focuses on the documentation, conservation, and creating public awareness of the traditional and historic built environment of Pakistan. In 2002, the foundation won the UN Recognition Award for promoting cultural and historical conservation. Her passion for historic preservation keeps her serving as an advisor to UNESCO.
In 2005, northern Pakistan suffered an earthquake of 7.6 magnitude on the Richter scale. More than 80,000 people passed away and left 400,000 families displaced. Even though she had not done disaster work before, she felt a calling to help and provide her skills as an architect in some way.
She focused on teaching volunteer locals to use local materials like bamboo and mud plaster and traditional building methods and architecture. They built choras, which are one-room homes in Pakistani villages. This was the beginning of Yasmin's second career, a career as a humanitarian architect.
Now, she and the locals she helps train and build houses for people in need, especially those affected by the environmental disasters like floods and earthquakes. Since the first decade of the 21st century, her foundation has built over 50,000 Pakistani homes.
This model of teaching locals to build their own homes using local techniques and preparing for disasters is known as barefoot social architecture.
She's been awarded the Jane Drew Prize in 2020, raising the profile of women in architecture and design. And she is the 2023 Reba Royal Gold Medal Award winner.
We could introduce Yasmin forever and ever. We shared her story on episode 91 and 92 of She Builds Podcast, and now we have the honor of having her join us today. Welcome, Yasmin Lari.
Yay. Hello, hello. How are you?
Okay, Mrs. Lari, let's start at the beginning. On our show, we love to tell the stories of women and share their accomplishments, but I'm always excited, me in particular of the three, I'm always excited about the person, the actual architect. If you could share anything about your childhood, your upbringing, what influences might have led to your career in architecture and preservations? Like, for example, I'm assuming your parents were very influential in what you did. I'm very curious about the impact that maybe your mom had. We've read a little bit about the work that your father did, but I'm curious to know about where did your mom fit in your upbringing?
All right, Jessica. So it's a long time ago. You must understand, huh? I'm 83 years old, so you can ask.
Any information. Of course,
at the time that I was growing up with Pakistan, my country had just got independence in 1947. And it was a kind of a difficult time because there was so much kind of bloodshed in terms of migration from the ones who had to come from so-called India to Pakistan and vice versa. And it just happened that my father, who had been serving with the British, he was what they call the Indian Civil Service. So he'd been trained by the British, and he was put in a very important position because at that time there were very few trained people. And so he was at the border at the time when independence happened and all the bloodshed began to occur. So although I was very young, but I think I went through all that to see what can happen with conflicts and how difficult it is when you get displaced. What do you do with yourself? Because there were stories, obviously. I don't think I went to the camps, but there were stories where my mother was working with the camps and the people. It was going to be very cold. And so, of course, they had to be, they had to really be supplying a lot of stuff. Also food, because they all came without anything at all and they were set up in camps in Lahore. And so that was one event that it was deeply etched in my memory, which I think probably is one of the reasons why I felt I needed to do something about others. And also the fact that both my mother and father were deeply involved with the community service, with the service to people who had been bereft of everything. I think that also left a mark on me. Although I have to say that I had such a privileged background, like many of us who did not really know what was happening elsewhere. And but I think the upbringing that we had was that it was a new country and we all had to work towards seeing what could be done. And there was a new vision that had to be brought in. And luckily, although my father was, obviously influenced by the British and European culture, but to answer Jessica's question, my mother was deeply religious. And although she tried her best to be part of the British colonial kind of service in that sense, but at the same time, she held on to her own roots. And I think that was something that gave me a lot of strength. I think although I did not know very much about my own self and my own culture, because we were so remote from everybody, we were living in a different world where the British, the world that British had left us, basically. But my mother was the one who really, in a sense, inculcated a lot of values about religion, about what needed to be done with people and so on and so forth. So I think it was a kind of a mixed upbringing, if you like. But my parents obviously had been very enlightened, because even though my mother was very conservative, but they wanted very much their daughters to study, which was very unusual at the time, and to take up professions. So we were very lucky. We were lucky to have these very enlightened parents, very unusual for the time. I mean, we are talking 1950s, right? Late 40s and early 50s, long before you were, around. So a different world.
Yeah, for sure. We are also curious just about how applying to architecture school. I know at that time you were then living in London or in the UK. And so what was that process like for you? Like you said, it was, you know, unusual for, you know, women to be getting higher education and things like that. So just curious your experience with both like applying to school, being in school. What was that process like?
Yeah, well, I was very young when I applied. I think I was just 15 or 16. And I'd not realized that to become an architect, you needed certain qualifications. I had my own, you know, I was in college, so in my first year of science, I was studying science, and then we went off to London. And I applied because my father had felt that there was a need in the country for architects and planners, as I said, to bring about a new vision for the new country. And so that had, of course, stuck with me. And I thought, well, I will come back and do things with my country. And I just thought, well, I'm in London. I will apply and get admission. But, of course, it was not to be at that time because they wanted a portfolio of drawings. I had none. They wanted certain school leaving certificates like the GCEs. I had none. I had other qualifications from back at home, but they were not considered quite at par with what they call the general certificate for education and the A-levels and O-levels and all the rest of it. So I had to go back to an art school, and I did my evening classes, and I managed to get the right sort of whatever certificates to be able to apply for architecture, and that's how I did finally. So it was hard work. It was two years of real slogging actually in London.
Yeah. And had you didn't really have any art classes up till that point, and that was sort of one of the things they. Or like we need to see a portfolio.
Well, I had some, Lizzie, but not enough. I had I'd done some, in school I'd been drawing and painting a little bit, but in college it was science, so I had not had a chance.
I see.
So really, I needed to become proficient with sketching, drawing, painting, and everything. And so the 2 years that I spent in the Ealing School of Art really did well. I did well in my A-level examinations for art, so I was fine.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
It's really important for us to listen to these stories because a lot of the ladies that we learn about were so resilient. They knew they wanted to study architecture. They went for it no matter what the hoops. And even in our careers, when we are facing challenges, we look at all these stories, all the struggles, everything that has been done, and we see this inspiration. So it was really interesting to learn about the process you went through at that time to enter architecture school. And then, like you said, you wanted to go back to your country and put that into action into building a new architecture there. So we're really curious, what were the challenges for you being the first woman to start her own firm in her country? How did you navigate all this? And then on top of that, motherhood, like there was a lot going on.
Yes. Well, finally, I think for women to be able to be productive, they need a very strong support system. And I was very lucky that I had it, first of all, with my own parents and encouraging me to do whatever I did want to do. And then my husband, who was then at Oxford, he was studying politics, philosophy, and economics. And he, of course, later on became a very noted historian. He was very supportive, both studying. He was doing his modern grades at Oxford, and I was studying architecture at Oxford School of Architecture, which is now Oxford Brookes. And we had a daughter while I was studying. So it was, but I think, you know, when you're young, you can do all that. You helped each other. There was not very much money. I learned to cook spaghetti, which was the cheapest food you could get. And because my husband was, he was in the habit of spending all his allowances that would come to buy books. So by the end of the month, we literally were down to just about, you know, having be real paupers actually. So, but we had a lovely flat up in the attic, where we used to entertain a huge number of people. My husband was very fond of inviting everybody as he walked down the street, whoever would be there to come and have lunch. And they all came because they thought it'd be lovely, Pakistani food. I don't know how they bore it because none of us knew how to cook properly. But it was wonderful times because we could just manage everything ourselves and there was no problem. Yes, so you just learn to do things yourself, or when it comes to you, you have to do it. There's no choice. So I never cooked in my life before. I learned to cook. I'd never known anything how to bring up a baby, but you know, we managed that. And so then we just came back home after we both graduated. I don't think there was any other thought in our minds to stay anywhere else. We thought, you know, we had to go home. There was much to do at home. So we just came back, returned to Pakistan.
So we're curious because we're all in the industry of architecture. So how did you achieve your first commission or like that first big project? And of course, how did it make you feel? How were you able to tackle that?
Yeah, well, as you know very well, it's a very difficult profession to, find your holding, if you like. And in the beginning, I think all of us have gone through the same kind of difficulties where nobody trusts you. They don't think mm-hmm. you can do very much. You're too young. And if you're female, then of course you will never have the capacity. They don't feel that you will be able to deliver. Right. So, of course, it was there. But luckily, I had a brother who had to build a house. And I was commissioned to do his house. I don't think I ever got paid for it, but it allowed me to do something that I really wanted to do. So I think the family is always very useful when you want to start, right? And so I was very fortunate. My parents, you know, wanted to build a house for him. And they thought, well, you know, we have an architect in the house. And, you know, so that was my first project. After that, I think after some people saw that, then they invited me. So in the beginning, it was just houses, you know, to do that, mm-hmm. to do for various kind of, and everybody was wealthy. I mean, they all had, so it was all good fun. You could do what you wanted to do. But in terms of other projects, I think my first major breakthrough was with the housing for the Navy, for Pakistan Navy. And I was very outspoken in my criticism for everything I didn't think was right. So I think there was some kind of a gathering and there was some discussion that a naval officer, a high-level naval officer was there. He was talking about how they were going to put up these multi-story units in, you know, one of their estates. And I never believed it. Somehow I said, no, why should you put multi-story buildings? Because those would be terrible for living for women and children. So, and I said, you know, it should be low rise and all the rest of it. And they couldn't understand. I said, well, why don't you show us what you can do? So I did my first sketches and they were approved. So I got my first major breakthrough that way. That happened. And it was lucky because the naval officers were very kind because every time they wanted to change something, I said, no, I can't do that. It'll destroy my concept of what I want to do. And they would, you know, they would immediately retract. So I was able to do what I wanted to do. And that's been good, you know, all through my life, more or less. I've been able to do the things that I thought were the right things. Because there's no point in messing around with your design if you don't think that, you know, if it will be the right thing or if it will destroy your own concept. So that was the first one. And then, and you mentioned about Anguri Bagh, and this was for the officers. So it was very rather higher kind of category. Anguri Bagh was really for the poor. It's interesting that you ask about Anguri Bagh because that had been largely forgotten until more recently. At that time, nobody really bothered much to say anything about it or look at it. Most architects did not feel that was something important to do because it was for the poor. It was for people who lived in a big ditch in Lahore. And I was lucky again. It was a socialist government and they invited me to design for these families that were threatened every year with the flooding in the ditch, wherever they were living. So by that time, I had reformed in the sense that I knew much more about my own tradition and my culture, which I had not known before I went to London. because after we came back, my husband and I went through a lot of old cities in Pakistan, the medieval cities, the walled cities. And suddenly it opened up my eyes to another way of living and doing things, which I had not known before. And in a sense, it was about learning myself as to what I was. And I think that was an eye-opening experience. And that's a phase I call my sort of relearning, unlearning and relearning phase. Because I had to learn, I had to really give up a lot of ideas and concepts that I had been taught, you know, in the UK or a sort of Western tradition. And I began to learn more about myself as to who I was and what the country was about and what the cultural traditions were. And so I think that helped a lot in my work with the Anguri Bagh housing, which was for the lower level, the lower strata of society. And that's the first time I got a chance to talk to women. I'd never done that before, really. I was just thinking as to what I needed to do, but really did not know what women's needs were. And then when I was designing that, I had a chance to have discussions, going and seeing with them, sitting with them. For the first time, I sat with the poor, actually, I have to tell you that. Never had been anywhere close to them. And I designed it, and it's a very economical housing because it's all on load-bearing walls and brick, which is the traditional material in Lahore. All the Mughal buildings were built in this very nice, lovely reddish brick, and the British did the same thing also. And then because I'd been to the old towns, especially in Lahore, it's a beautiful walled city. You should come there and have a look at it sometime. It has got the life is on multi levels of terraces, right? I mean, partly you live inside, but also there are these open spaces. And everybody has a little terrace so that you can come out. Also, the streets are narrow and winding. And so it was a different way of design. I mean, you in the US, I think, are going in the wrong direction completely with your gridiron pattern and everything done for vehicles. So once you take away vehicles and you have just pedestrian areas like you do in medieval towns in Europe, it's a different feel altogether. And so I was able to take the lessons from Lahore Walled City and apply them to my new housing. So when we had this amazing gathering in one of the most beautiful gardens called the Shalimar Bagh in Lahore, which was actually held by the socialist finance minister of that government, he invited for the first time the poor of the city to be there. It had never been done. The garden was really, whenever there were assemblies, it was for the heads of states or, I don't know, all kinds of dignitaries. And in that, I was asked to present my case, if you like, and I did. Mm-hmm. And the women then said, well, okay, but tell us, moving us to this, but where will our chickens be? And I think to a man, it must have been a very frivolous question, but for me, it was a very serious question. Mm-hmm. That's when I learned that what you do, you have to do for the benefit of women and for children. If you don't do it, then you've lost the whole thing. So I told them, I said, well, you know, we have these terraces. Every one of, even if you're on the first, second floor, you will have a terrace. And that's where your chickens will be. You'll grow vegetables and your children can also play there. So that is what gave me the approval. So this is the story behind Anguri Bagh. And that's where my whole interest in women started and what I felt I needed to do. Right.
That's great.
Yeah. I love that. I love that so much. We could talk about that for a long time. But you also mentioned that you went and you studied the walled cities. Is that where the beginning of your interest in preservation architecture?
You see, because when I was practicing as an architect, I just took on the projects I really wanted to do. I didn't want to become like a production factory of, you know, the same kind of stuff coming out. And so there were lean times. Always there were lean times, right? And of course, because you can keep busy, obviously, you can do lots of projects. But I just didn't feel that it would be the best thing for me to do. And then somehow, because of this whole interest in heritage, trying to understand oneself, and then I felt that a lot of heritage was being destroyed. So we needed to see at least a document, because I had no other way to record, to keep it, you know, in some way for posterity, because I could not save the destruction, but I could document. And also, I think, again, to try to understand myself, unless I studied these, I did not know. So my husband, who was actually running an insurance company at the time, we decided to set up this particular foundation. At that time, I had a chance to go to, to the UK and to the US several times. And I found that there were such strong movements there for saving historic buildings. If you remember, I think it was the early 1900s, probably, or was it later? I think that was more in the UK, but in the US as well. It was the women who started to try to preserve the pavements of Boston. That's when the whole movement started for conservation, you know? Yes. And I was able to see what was going on, where there was a lot of work. This was me, I'm talking of, let's say, late 70s and early 80s. A lot of work was going on in your cities as well at that time of preservation. And, you know, done quite incredible work, although your heritage is not as ancient as ours is. Okay,
so
although
true.
It's comparatively new. Yeah.
Right.
Right. But it's very important. And so for us also, there was a lot of destruction of British period buildings, because we felt that there was a love-hate relationship. We wanted to destroy it because it reminded us of the past. But also we'd had this very great tradition of the Mughals and then the Hindu dynasties and all kinds of, which were quite breathtaking there in their grandeur. And so I think people generally felt, well, we can just get rid of them, you know? And that's the reason why I felt that for cities, they were so important. I mean, the British period buildings are really, really the most dominant factor were at the time. And they needed to be saved because that's what gave identity to many of our cities. They were in the downtown, okay? Mm-hmm. And so the mm-hmm. only way I could do it was to start documenting. But at the same time, I don't know whether you've seen my book or have come across at least an illustration, which is about Tata, which was an ancient town in Sindh, which has these wind catchers. And we managed to document that, started off with that in 1979, actually. And then I brought it out as a book as well later on, which is the wind catchers of that city. Amazing kind of contraption, which brings the breeze into the rooms. So without any kind of mechanical means, right? I mean, this is all natural way of ventilation.
Yeah.
So I wrote that book, and that's the time that we asked Journey started for documentation, because then we felt that we need to establish something, do it regularly. And because my husband was running a fairly successful, or was at that time, insurance company, so he was able to contribute, and I had my office. I was able to contribute because really they were, as I said, lean times, and it was very good to be able to keep my colleagues going and get them to do this productive work. So it really, I'm not sure whether I planned everything, but the way my life has been, I've had these opportunities and I've just used them. So yeah. That's how it all started. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I like what you talked about with just sort of that love-hate relationship, but like it's still a part of the history and it's still important to like where you guys got to today as a country. And so, and like learning from those things and documenting them is such a big deal.
I think it's important to save as much as possible of whatever the footprints of the past are, because they're all the ones that will help you to develop as to what you are. And if you lose them, then you've really lost a part of your own self in a sense. So yeah, it doesn't matter what period it is. It doesn't matter what we've gone through. And we can also always debate about, you know, colonialism, and there's a whole movement now about decolonization, which I think is the right thing the way to go. But it doesn't mean that they destroy those, you know, because those have become part of our own history.
Yes.
And also, most of these structures have been built by local people. So there mm-hmm. you can see how their skills at that time were so good. That's
sure.
why they were able to do all that. And although the imagery was European, but then there's a lot of, you have a lot of eclectic kind of designs as well, which you see a kind of a, you know, a kind of combination or mixture of different traditions. So
yeah.
they were built at that time, but important skills, I think, you know,
right? Yeah, no, exactly. Mm-hmm. So in 2000, you retired from architectural practice or like from your firm. And at that point, right, what were your plans for retirement? Like, did you, and I, maybe you sort of touched on this a little bit in that thing, you know, your, the path your life has taken is just sort of, you've used what's come at you, but did you sort of expect this whole second career to happen, or were you sort of shifting focus from like your traditional architecture practice?
I think both in a sense, Lizzie, because I think a time came, I'd become very successful in the 80s and 90s, and I put up these monster buildings. And so corporate sector was very much my, at that time, something that I was working with all the time. And I think a time came, and everyone gave you, every one of the commissions gave you a chance to do something different. So it wasn't that, there was variation. Mm-hmm. But I think I just felt that it was, although I could design, and you know, I could have different kind of concepts and design and have them implemented. But finally, when you looked at it, it's the same kind of brief that would come to you. It was the same kind of expectations. And and somehow it's all to do with the with very rich and very kind of, you know, influential kind of organizations. And then by the end of 2000, I decided it was really the same thing going on with a different garb, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that I wanted to continue with that. But also something happened in the meantime. My husband, whose insurance company was not doing so well, decided to sell it because the socialist government had actually nationalized a lot of the industry that was owned by the family, because somehow the name appeared among the most wealthy 22 families. So to teach us a lesson, more or less everything was taken away that could have brought profits. So the family fell on bad times. My husband tried to carry on with this insurance company. My brother was doing another one, somebody else. So anyhow, so then he decided to sell it, and he wanted always to write, and he became a writer and a historian and a writer. And he'd been doing it for some years, and I decided, well, that's not fair. I need to do my books as well, you know, so I should retire too. So I decided to give up. And I thought, that is it now. I'll be now sitting. And you know, because we'd done a lot of research, there was a lot of material we'd got. My husband had been a good photographer. Everybody was drafted into the work. My son, who was studying at Harvard at the time, whenever he would come, he would have to go and take photographs. And what he called the cottage industry, he said, because everything was being done here with among ourselves, you know. And because, of course, we didn't have any other financial resources except what we were putting in ourselves. So there was a lot of material that had been collected by that time. And I thought it was time to sit down and just, you know, put it all together, compile it, because I think that was also important. And also to write. I'd done a couple of books, and I thought I could do more. My husband was better at history and everything. He was a better educated person than myself. But then I finally learned to write. Because then as a professional, I don't know about America, but in the UK at the time, we were never asked to write anything. You know, everything to do was with design, mm-hmm, or with expressing, you know, through sketches and whatever. But I think in your country, you are taught more about, you know, everybody learns to write very well, actually, when you do your undergraduate. So, but so for me, it was hard work to learn to write, okay?
Yeah.
And to do research. But I managed that. And anyhow, so then, so he was now writing books and becoming well-known. And here I was struggling with my, you know, architectural practice. So I wrapped it up. I completely wrapped it up. I said, this is it now. I'd done a building for a foreign bank called the ABN Amro Bank at the time. And I decided that's it. But I wasn't able to sit down to write because then UNESCO got in hold of me. And then I was made UNESCO's National Advisor at the Lahore Fort with a fantastic site, amazing. Again, something that I never thought I would be given a chance to be able to work in. And I was able to have a whole team of really very capable people from Pakistan, from abroad, because there was this beautiful mirror-encrusted ceiling in the Sheesh Mahal, 17th century, built by Shah Jahan, this great emperor. And wow. And it was collapsing. And it had to be somehow, you know, we had to save it from, and you could not really do mm-hmm. anything from the bottom. It had to be done from the top. So it was a difficult assignment. But that gave me a chance also to stay in the fort for 3 years. And right. there I managed to get documentation done of everything, literally, which had never been done before, except the British, who were very good at documenting. I don't know whether you know, but they've done fantastic drawings of all kinds of historic structures. And but in the fort, they were all these drawings that were done, basic drawings, but they were lost. Nobody knew where they were. And what they were, I managed to find them, and then we managed to really make proper, you know, really as-built drawings of the structures. I managed to train uh-huh. a lot of people there. So that was one thing that was quite amazing to do, but also to discover in their archives all that existed that somehow they never have exposed before. But I got a chance to look at all that because I'd been actually writing a manuscript on Mughal architecture. So that was great. I never managed to finish the book because I got involved in so many other things. But at least, you know, I wanted to. I knew when I was there what was happening in those days in the 17th century. Where would the emperor be sitting? And where would his wife, the queen, would be walking? And I could do that myself. I could experience all of that. Because at night, there was nobody else. It was only myself. So amazing experience, amazing chance. But I think before I didn't really realize, but that prepared me for the work in the disaster area afterwards. I never used lime in my life before. Mm. As a self-respecting architect, of course, you never used lime, you only use cement, right? I mean, you've done that yeah. too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'd never known how to use lime except in, you know, in conservation. Of course, one knew. But it was for conservation, not for normal construction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but there I learned about lime as to mm-hmm. how you should slake it, what you do, and what can it do.
Yeah.
So somehow I feel that now that I look back, that, you know, all these chances I got in life was really to prepare me for something else, something, you know, that I could do later.
Mm-hmm. So setting
it's always,
you
know, I've had this kind of, yeah, somehow setting me up for this. So I did not know that about the disaster. I never knew. I'd never done any work on the disaster before. I mean, I was actually in the fort at the time that earthquake happened in 2005. Mm-hmm. And wow. I was at that time, I think of now saying, okay, I've set everything up and now I need to go back to Karachi. And, you know, I mean, I was in Lahore, but I was constantly traveling in between. It wasn't that I'd shifted to Lahore, but still that meant that I could give up, you know, worrying about the fort and do something else with my life.
Yeah.
But then that happened. So that's how I was finally there.
Hmm. So what are you working on today? Are you going to like officially retire and like finish the book? Relax.
Yeah. Jessica, I wish I could finish the books. You know, I've got so many on the computer, and I keep on looking and saying, "My God, when do I do them?" You know, I need to do them. But no, I think the earthquake taught me a lot of lessons. It changed my life literally. It changed the course of my life, and I didn't know that as an architect I could do anything at all in that. We talk of 2005 and. You know, this was not something that architects did. And I'd never been trained for that. And when I first went, I wasn't sure what I could do, except that it was such a major disaster, as you explained, Najee, that, you know, one felt that one had to go and do something about it, like everybody else in the country, and actually from outside the country also. So many people came to help. And I had so many young volunteers, I can't tell you, from abroad as well as from Pakistan, who came and, you know, worked with hauling the stone and because I was working with the debris and so on. So that taught me a lot of lessons, but also that I worked with women who'd somehow been left behind because there were not enough women in the, whoever went to help, they're mostly male, you know, organizations with male sort of employees. So nobody really knew what was happening with women, because you could not enter their quarters. I mean, this is, you know, in our society is very conservative in certain areas, and so only women could go to see other women. So again, I had the advantage. I mean, I've had just all kinds of advantages, you know. So I could go there, I could talk to them, I could see what their needs were. And we started off, I learned about, you know, how craft could be so important in their lives. I mean, I knew about crafts, of course I knew, but never knew the importance that it had in their own living kind of situations. And they did this beautiful beadwork that they could not do anymore. So that's where we started. We started off getting them to be able to do the beadwork. And that's how they suddenly, you know, the depression was gone. They were able to do many things. They became so productive. So with women, you only have to do a bit of a hand-holding and they rise. I mean, it's amazing how much they're able to do. So, but that's taught me a lot of lessons while I worked there. And then since then, of course, Pakistan, as you know, is the fifth most vulnerable country as far as climate change is concerned and the natural disasters. So, so we had this major, I've been just about in every area where either a flood or an earthquake has happened in Pakistan. And then, of course, we had this major flood 2022. So that's what we are involved in now. That's what I'm really working in right now.
So, question I wanted to ask you, what are your aspirations for your foundation, for the work that you're doing with Barefoot Social Architecture?
Barefoot Social Architecture, I think, is becoming more important as the world is confronted with more and more disasters. Because as you must know, the severity is increasing all the time. And every time the displacement is of horrendous proportions. I mean, it's amazing. Do you know that we had 2022 flood, 33 million people were displaced. 3 million households were without or are still without shelter or food or anything. So it's like, and when you look at humanity, I mean, today 1 in 10 persons, or the figures change from 1 to 9, 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 people go hungry every night. So, and then you look at the conflicts. You look at the displacement because of conflicts. I mean, brutality and everything go hand in hand. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So the question is that, how do you tackle unless there are more people who are sensitive and who get involved and more architects get involved in this kind of work? I mean, I feel that if you want to do the right thing by the planet, there should be more architects in all these fields. Mm-hmm. Because right now what you have is charlatans. I call them charlatans because they are highly paid consultants, come out of nowhere and will do absolutely the wrong thing. High carbon solutions, not knowing, not having the sensitivity as to what the cultural, you know, imperatives are. How do you deal with communities? They have no sensitivity to all that. And there are not enough architects who will be there, unfortunately. So I really feel architects have to expand their canvas now. They cannot continue just doing the work, which is, I mean, you've got to get out of your comfort zone. Can't just keep on doing the comfortable thing. When you get a commission and you say, okay, fine, we'll just do it. Well, why can't everybody be more like an activist? Go and say, well, this community needs some help. Why can't I help them? Because design is the greatest strength is the design that you use as a tool to improve people's lives. Right? So unless architects at every front, I don't know how things will change. And this is what I keep on talking to everybody. I mean, initially when they awarded me the Royal Gold Medal, I was really concerned. I talked to President Simon Alford when he called me. I said, Simon, you're going to be in trouble. Why have you done this? Because all the, you know, famous architects will be unhappy about this. I mean, who am I? So, but then, you know, later, and also all through, actually, because I've been giving lots of lectures because of Zoom and everything else, otherwise also in person as well, it's really the young people were saying, we want to do something like this, but how do we do it? And at that time, I got so many messages from really from women and from young architects who were so happy about it. I never knew that that would resonate with them. And so I feel really responsible. I feel the only thing I can do with that award is to see what I can do to help young architects to do what they wish to do now, not just wait for a commission to go and do and work for the wealthy.
As I'm listening to you, I'm also thinking, man, we need to do something. Hopefully this talk is inspiring everyone as much as it's been inspiring us. I mean, the reason we were drawn to you was the work that you're doing with Barefoot Social Architecture. All architects deep down really want to do something. They want to do more. And then to see someone doing it, paving the way, that helps us continue the ball rolling.
I think what's important now is do a lot of hand-holding for young architects. I think we need, and I keep on saying this everywhere where I'm able to speak or I'm asked to speak, that we need architectural incubators in universities where they could give the space and provide mentoring for 2 or 3 years, where institutes such as the, I don't know about AIA, but I mean, I don't know them, but RIBA and UIA and all the rest of them, I've been talking to and saying, well, you can get a lot of funding from product manufacturers. And so the funding would come from there, but the architects would be paid. A young architect can't go and do pro bono work. I mean, it's not fair. So to get them paid, there must be funding.
Right.
And the tech industry nurtures their young people. We don't do it. Why aren't we doing it?
Yeah, that's a very great point.
If somebody wants to go and work in communities, how would you do it? You can't have a commission from the community. Or if you want to work in the humanitarian field, maybe you can find a job with some NGO or whatever. But, I mean, there's no possibilities for them.
Yeah.
The legal profession has pro bono wings. Do we have any pro bono wings? I mean, I was told, yes, we have all these, we give all these scholarships. That's not good enough.
No.
I think we have to really change the way that we all practice. And this whole thing, the business about commissions, until you get a commission, you can't take up a job or take up a project. Why not? Why can't you be an entrepreneur? Can't you be an activist? Why can't you just, if you find injustice somewhere, you've got to fight it out, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So if you have environmental injustice, what do you do? When you have ecological injustices, when you have people living in slums or homeless or whatever, you just sit back and say, this is not my concern. How can it not be a concern?
Yeah.
So I think the profession has to change if it wants to remain relevant. How many big iconic buildings will you build in life or now? Considering the whole issue of climate change and how sustainability is becoming such a big issue. So I think architects got to just start rethinking. The whole professional landscape has got to change. And young people want this, yeah. I know. Because you guys are more aware of how bad things are today in terms of the health of the planet, living conditions of people. Cities are becoming impossible.
Yeah.
The use of concrete, which is done nothing but providing with heat islands. I mean, they're just everywhere. So, and architects should be there in big force, I think, to fight it all out, because we know this is not the right thing. And unless we do it, which is the other profession that can do it all? I mean, you know about the contest. You know what people, needs of people are. You know how to collaborate. You know how to put everything together. Well, which other profession has all this? You have the design ability to improve people's lives. So why aren't we doing it everywhere? You know?
Yeah.
I think that's what I want to ask you guys. I mean, you better... I think you need to do something about it, right? If you want a better world for yourself. Yeah. I mean, people, my people like me are passé now. I mean, how much life do we have to live? It doesn't really matter anymore to me, to my generation. But it does matter to you guys, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So I think we do think about it.
Yeah, yeah, I think you, I mean, you bring up so many good points, but especially just the way the profession is structured now, or the way that we teach young architects, like it's not like, to your point that a lot of people are like, I want to do this, but I don't know how. And so I think your idea about incubators in schools and things like that is a great way, because even like, I hear this a lot too, that like, you know, even coming out of school, like architects don't know how to run their own business even, you know, like they don't teach us that in school very well either. And like, to your point of being entrepreneurs, like there's just lots of different aspects of like how you could use architecture in a different way that we don't get taught in school. And so then we don't see those opportunities for us coming out of school and going into the profession. And to your point, yeah, like a young architect can't just be like, I'm going to work pro bono. You know, so if those opportunities aren't there for them, or that structure isn't set up, then, you know, it just keeps the status quo of what things are like. So.
I don't know if it's the sleep deprivation, because it's like almost 12:45 a.m. But like for me, but like I got a little misty eyed. I was like, I can't believe we're doing this, and having her speak like the season of Living Legends, episode 91 and 92. So to have her talk about her work, like, and the way that she talked about it, it was like energizing and like reinvigorating.
I do feel like this strong call to action. Let's see how we can get involved. Or
yeah,
I hope. Yeah. I'll reach out to her.
Yeah, because if there's ways to directly contribute, I am 100% in.
Down.
Because I think that's always that's always a lot of those issues, right? Is exactly what she was saying. These intermediaries, and you don't really know where your aid is going to, and that kind of thing. So, like, yeah, I would love to be helping out with that in whatever way we can.
I just like how she was calling out everybody, these organizations, these institutions, or even just people that say like, "Oh, I would love to do this, but I don't know how," or "I'd love to." I don't know. She was just like, to me, she gave like the most positive, sweet kick in the pants to like, nah, just do it. Like, just go. Just like, make it happen. Like, don't, like, just jump. And at least that's what I got from it. And it's, I think she talked about how her life changed after the earthquake. But I think after this conversation, she's changed a lot of my thinking of what can you do in this profession. And I really liked it.
Well, I hope that all of you out there listening enjoyed it as much as we did. Please let us know what topics that you'd like us to have Charette's on, and you might hear a future episode based on your suggestion. Again, thanks for listening.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, and Gable Media is all about building a better world. If this sounds right up your alley, which it probably does, listen and subscribe to all the shows at Gable Media. That's GABLmedia.com.
Please let us know what you thought of this the Charette and our show. We really value your input and feedback. Tell your friends, your activists, your professors, your organizations. Tell everybody. Tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes and write us a review.
You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X at shebuildspod. Bye.
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 Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach.
By becoming NCARB certified, like I did, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses.
Learn more at ncarb.org.